Well, I won't give much background to this. As you know, and as after going through Sloterdijk last term, which was so interesting for me, it was really, really helpful, and got me thinking about when I was a undergraduate. I was very frustrated with a lot of the philosophers who were trendy at the time. I mean, really, this was a very long time ago, and structuralism was all in and big and cool, and Barthes was very cool, but actually he was already, Derrida was already still more cool, and that kind of determined a certain tone to things. And while I was really excited by all of this, excited by Heidegger, it wasn't the tone that was right for me. There's something in that philosophical move that wasn't speaking to my understanding of truth or of reality or of the ethics, the ethos that comes out of that. I think one of the problems with Derrida's philosophy is that the ethos and ethics that he creates hasn't always, I'm not sure that it's had to be appropriated and applied to things, but I'm not sure that it was very successful in every way as an ethics. Although all the Derridians in the world will hunt me down and kill me for saying so, but and I think over, I happened to come upon Gadamer, really. It's not that I was like, I have to do Gadamer for my PhD. I came upon him because he just seemed terribly sensible. He seemed accurate rather than glamorous. And I was really interested in issues of religious truth at that time. One of the big debates in religious studies was, what is religious belief? What is its nature? Is it propositional? Is it asserting truths? And should we be fighting over the truths of whether there's a God, etc., etc.? And that was kind of turning into a question about how to understand religious discourse, which was turning into a question about different kinds of religious discourses, which is more where we stand now, where we analyze different forms of religious language. And that was all very useful, and I got into doing Gadamer. And over the years of struggling with him, because he can be phenomenally boring to read, I realized that he had all these virtues that I respected both as a scholar and as a person. Virtues to do with a commitment to clarity, and the idea that philosophical truths, once firmly established, will show, they will tell and last. And also a commitment to a kind of humility, I think. He's taught by some of the biggest, loudest, most vocal, most prophetic, most charismatic figures in 20th century thought, right? He's right there in Heidegger's circle, precisely in the period in which everybody is kind of courting the favor of these major professors, when being part of their circle is more than simply learning what they have to say. It's living a lifestyle. It's kind of buying into a prophetic voice about how we should be living. And Gadamer benefits from this, but does not want to be that person. I might have to close the window. Doesn't want to. It's okay. Doesn't want to. Oh, thank you. Doesn't want to be that person. Doesn't want to be a charismatic leader in the way that he's seeing people like Heidegger doing that. I think he likes truth. And as we'll see, I'll talk about this. He also, I think, cares about history in a different way. Heidegger is in a Nietzschean place where he wants to reject a portion of history and change and alter and set out on a new path. And Gadamer has a strong kind of affection in him, I think. He doesn't have very much anger in him, and he has a lot of affection. So he's much more reappropriative of figures from the past. And reappropriating figures from the past is often less glamorous than hitting them on the head. So Hollywood would agree. So we've got a very different kind of ethos coming out in Gadamer, and a lot of that I think is quite important. And the irony for me is that Gadamer, on the one hand, has become completely embedded in the way that we study religion, the way that we study texts, the way that we study cultures now. So he's become completely embedded throughout the human sciences, in fact. But at the same time, I think the most interesting parts of what he has to say have been completely ignored, partly because he writes so boringly. But also, I think, because we aren't kind of ready for the implications. We've had Derrida saying, truth is indeterminate. Oh my gosh, what are we going to do about it? And that's been a useful revolutionary gesture to say that. It's been a great challenge. Derrida is a great challenger. But Gadamer tries to take insights and say, now we're going to have to live with this indeterminacy of truth. We're going to have to live in a different understanding of what reality is, of what our own consciousness is. And we're going to have to live in it in such a way that this isn't a revolutionary moment in history. This is our truth. This is what we are. This is a permanent re-understanding of the human and of language and of meaning itself. And I think we haven't altogether been ready for that. And one of the messages of the seminar series is going to be, I think Gadamer wants to take things that have been often seen as negative in kind of modern, i.e. late 20th century post-phenomenological understandings of meaning, etc. Things that have been seen as negative or problematic or challenging for us. Heidegger wants a God to come and save us. Levinas feels, again, that only there's a space of transcendence that the God must fill. There's a kind of a nostalgia for something else that will come and make it better because our circumstance currently is not adequate for human life. Just as meaning itself is so indeterminate, we can never be certain of truths, etc. All these things are seen as challenging and difficult and problematic. And Gadamer wants to show us that if you go all the way and understand the true nature of text, of meaning, of language, and of the human, you'll see this is all very positive. And that, in fact, it indicates a way of living which is also very, very positive. And again, I think one of the theses of this course is that it's A, very spiritual. As I'll say, Gadamer is seen as a highly secular thinker because he's not a post-Catholic like Heidegger. He's not a Jewish thinker like Levinas, like Derrida, nor is he kind of a Protestant reappropriator like Ricoeur or aspects of Heidegger's thought. He himself is, I'll say, is basically quite secular, and he's seen as therefore unconcerned with spirituality and ethics, and I think that's the wrong way to see him. And I'll be talking a lot about poetry because I think he sees poetry as the place in which spirituality happens. And also, he's a globalist. He's there in globalism in 1960 in a way that no one else has quite understood what it's going to mean to live in a world of multiple cultures. In a world in which dialogue is the norm. It's not that you're in a tradition. The insider-outsider debate in religious studies says, I'm in a tradition. How can I talk to people in that tradition over there? I can't. And I think what's happening is in the modern world, we're going, wait a second, which tradition am I in? One tradition? Which one? Most of us in Oxford here at this table are in more than one tradition. Right, and the very phenomenon of being from different cultures or converting to another culture or simply becoming deeply conditioned by other cultural means that we no longer have that kind of monolithic understanding that dialogue and creative juxtaposition is already what we're doing in a way. And I think Gadamer again wants to say that is the norm that we want to start appropriating as our positive medium in which we live today, and to seeing how that works in a very positive way. So he's kind of an early globalist. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about, I think, Gadamer's. I'm going to talk a bit about Gadamer's implications for modern thought, modern religious studies specifically, because this is in preparation for a book called Gadamer on Religion for a series by Equinox, the publishers. So I'll talk a bit about his relation to religious studies. And then I'll go on just to talk a little bit about his life and his biography and the idea that the story of of Western philosophy that you get from Descartes, Nietzsche, Heidegger is not the story of Western philosophy that Gadamer is living, right? There's other versions of Western thought, of Western spirituality even, right, that you don't hear. Just as the 20th century is told as a history about, let's say, war and capitalism, but a lot of people experience the 20th century as a history of the 60s and spiritual discovery, right? But that's not part of the kind of accepted narrative in quite the same way. So I think there's an alternative history to be found. So if you want to tell a story of Gadamer, let me narrate his life in a different way. I want to talk about the Gadamer who, as a child, finds himself at home, not struggling with a religious heritage, but rather with his mother on one side, who was a German pietist, kind of a Swabian piety, he said. I was raised in the air of Swabian piety, a kind of an ethos of very private, very personal, not very verbal, not very creedal, but very intense, focused in internal spiritual life. Right. So rather than Heidegger, who's struggling with whether or not there's a God and what kind of God it is ontologically, he has an assurance of an internal spirituality, which fits actually rather well in a way with the fact that his father on the other side was a biologist, basically a secular biologist. Right. But that conflict, that science versus religion conflict, for him is not manifesting as a conflict. Right, because he's, again, he's getting an alternative history. That kind of spirituality didn't really cause a problem in the same way. So we've already got a young man who's got a different sense of how the natural world and the spiritual world interact. Let's jump forward to Gadamer's sort of early, his youth, his teenage and his early university education. And we see Gadamer as someone who, rather than struggling with Cartesian certainties or what have you, became very interested in the Stefan George, the circle of people who were fans of Stefan George's poetry. George is a poet who wrote poetry that had it was kind of almost seen as having an esoteric element to it, something that's very personal, something very profound, poetry that is seen as inspirational, but is also slightly cryptic. So it's not giving you, it's not like Hölderlin here are clear tradition-bound messages about inspiration, nature, nation, etc. Something that again leans into a very personal form of spirituality, and which for aimed at young people, aimed at a kind of a liberal, open development of one's personal life. And that was important for him, both in terms of shaping what he understands to be important for the growth and flourishing of young people, and also how he sees poetry as something, how that's supposed to work. Leap forward much further, and you see Gadamer as a young doctoral student. You see Gadamer later into his spiritual life, his professional life, where he's having to kind of shyly admit to Heidegger that he really likes Plato, that he thinks Plato and Aristotle are not opposed necessarily, and that there are philosophers who are kind of out of fashion, people like Leibniz, like Spinoza, like Hegel, hugely. Who he sees as having a really important hold still on core truths about the world as a medium of meaning, of concepts, that is, and those concepts are something that are constantly unfolding through history, in new texts, in new historical events, in new ideas, lives, etc. So that when he gets to read, on the one hand, he's interested in the human sciences and the natural sciences, and when he reads people like Oettinger, who are interested in how we understand biology, biological development, the development of organisms through history. He reads that, and then he reads Paul Celan, the great French-German philosopher, who writes poetry full of natural imagery, and his imagery of natural objects flourishing, growing in their mysterious silence, expresses both what poetry is about and what nature appears to be about. He doesn't see these two paradigms, this biological and this poetic paradigm, as opposed. He sees them as expressing a common insight, again, about growth, about something to do with the idea that history contains a constant upwelling and flourishing of different forms that are important to us, constitute us, and with which we're concerned. So he's seeing a different vision, if you like, of history than the one that is kind of fashionable at the time. And the last little vignette of Gadamer's life, much later in life, when he's an established authority, when those people who were his teachers and overshadowed him are now gone, and he's starting to set the agenda. And he was in a symposium with Derrida, in which Derrida said, "Look, Gadamer, your notion of meaning is too traditional, it's too solid, it's too concrete. I've shown that we can't really have clear communications. I've shown that meaning dissolves into uncertainty. What you hear isn't what I said, and we have to give up on kind of concrete conceptions of communicating a message anymore." And Gadamer, and this was all very exciting, of course, and Derrida was younger, and Derrida was French, which is cooler, and you know, and also not unimportant that Derrida was Jewish and Gadamer was German, who was very much present in all that went on under National Socialism. You know, Derrida seems as if he's making the stronger, more radical point. And Gadamer came back very briefly in response to this and said, "Son," he didn't say son. Kid. No, he didn't say kid either. He said, "You know, look, in telling me that I cannot understand you, you are communicating with me. Right? You believe in communication. You may have particular messages and you may have particular emphases that you want to highlight. But you are communicating. You're communicating because that is really important to your very being alive, and certainly the reason why you're here. And in fact, communicating is what you've devoted your life to." He doesn't say it quite like that, but that's the core of his message, right? So, and I think it's interesting to see in that the culmination of a lot of what he's been saying during his life about the universality of the nature of communication, But and also I think to see some of the ethics. When I say ethics, I don't mean morality. I mean the ethos of how you live based on this insight into meaning. I think for Gadamer, it's kind of like saying to the younger man, young man, what you do to thrive and live and flourish is to communicate, right? What you're communicating is really cool, but the very fact of growing through communication is in fact crucial to what you've chosen to do with your life and what humans choose to do with their lives. And for him, communicating, as we'll see, is much more than trying to get a message across to somebody else. It's actually a form of growing. So that kind of trajectory of Gadamer's lives, touching on these different points in history, is important. And I think it points to a philosophy and an ethics that are of value. So this first section, I'm calling this of the four seminars, this is Gadamer as the repairman. Later we'll see Gadamer as a bridge builder or as a gardener or as a kind of a social host. What's the word for the person who invites everyone to a party and then makes sure everyone has fun? It's just the host, I guess. Yeah, okay, so we'll see him in the last section as a host. But he's the repairman. In a philosophical establishment that since Descartes, Hegel, and particularly Nietzsche, is very much the historical revisionist, in a philosophical establishment that had wanted to correct the trajectory of historical thought and repair its damage to the modern cultural ethos. So I think both Nietzsche and Heidegger are seeing themselves as trying to fix a damage that's been done in history by people like Plato. Gadamer saw himself as more of a repairman, quite a cautious repairman. He's surrounded by these prophetic figures like Husserl, who wants to go back to foundations. Husserl's kind of doing what Descartes is doing. That's why he calls his text Cartesian Meditations. And if you read the beginning of Cartesian Meditations, Derrida says, you know, the important thing in philosophy is to get rid of history, get rid of the past, get rid of all your assumptions and start from the beginning again. And you've got all these figures in this period in the early 20th century trying to do that, break it all down, start it all again. And they present, a lot of them not only were doing that in their project, they were presenting their work as a kind of a prophetic transformation. Their tone is prophetic. A lot of people say that Heidegger's writing reads oddly because it's meant to be spoken in a lecture hall in this kind of prophetic tone, and you've got the personality and the charisma, and you're taking people through an experience of thinking that changes them, right? It's not really meant to be a sort of text in the way that we tend to read it today. So Gadamer's surrounded by this. But I think Gadamer wanted to employ a more humble, cautious, affirmative, and appreciative tone. He believed that the resources for conflictless, meaning-filled, better living existed, right? So we can get rid of conflict, we can fill our lives with meaning, and we have it here. And he was constantly encountering them in the works that he was constantly working with in his own life. And so he wants to kind of bring this back. He wants to find these unexpected sources and revive, if you like, modern way of thinking. So in these seminars, I want to explore that larger vision that drives Gadamer's hermeneutics. Here we see a kind of a gentle prophet, who through careful thinking, he's really serious about the idea of careful philosophical thinking and its truths, and a certain kind of German humanistic upbringing that we don't always hear about, I think, is this almost this idea that Germany, with all its... Germany gets a lot of trouble for some awkward things that happened in the 20th century, but also interesting to remember that Germany was the country that was not engaged in the colonial enterprise in quite the same way. Germany has a huge tradition of classics and Orientalist scholarship. It has a huge tradition of travel in ways that are not the same as the colonial sort of background that you find in places like Oxford, for instance. And that all of that feeds into the way that Gadamer is doing things, and I think he wants to bring that out. And he wants to redefine many key ideas that have become problematic, including truth, including reality itself, and including, I think, human nature, including spirituality and globalism. To some extent, as I said, Gadamer has become core to religious studies. His philosophical hermeneutics transformed the way we think about belief, truth, bias, which of course is this huge thing at the center of religious studies debates, cultural background and bias, and conflict as well. And it's become pervasive not only in these areas throughout the human sciences. The immediate impact was enormous. Garrett Green writes, a single book, Truth and Method, catapulted hermeneutics into the center of discussion in theology and religious studies in the second half of the 20th century and has made Gadamer's name synonymous with hermeneutical theory. Yeah, I found that out. I remember when I first started doing it, I was really excited. At some point in your PhD, you get really excited because you understand it all for the first time. You're like, oh, this applies to everything. And I remember going to many of my best friends and being like, hermeneutics, it's all about hermeneutics. And they go, what? hermeneutics. And I go, no, well, it's kind of like discourse. And they go, what do you mean by discourse? And it was very hard to kind of encourage other people to be quite so excited. But in fact, of course, this turned out to be essential because it's simply the reading of texts. And I want to emphasize the idea that the reading of text has become something much bigger. If Gadamer's roots are in the study of the German study of scripture, right? That's one of his main roots as a scholar, and he's coming out of Schleiermacher, he's coming out of Diltai, he's very much engaged in reading these figures, in some ways very much aware of the Lutheran heritage. Luther is the first person who says, let's go back and reread the text, let's rethink the way that the text is speaking. And Luther's idea that the text isn't just giving you some information on how to get to heaven, the text is speaking to you in terms of a personal relationship of faith with God. And that the message it gives to you is an expression of God's private discussion with you. And that therefore the biblical text actually has very specific personal independent meanings, right? That already is the beginning of the German hermeneutic scriptural idea that texts are personal, are in a sense relative to each individual. And Gadamer's coming out of that tradition as it kind of rolls on to, for instance, Rudolf Bultmann, who's kind of saying the same thing, demythologize the text. It's not about a set of facts that we should argue about. It's about a message, and indeed a message that's supposed not only to talk to you or communicate with you, but to transform you. So we have text already changing its nature and meaning as changing its nature and purpose and what it's supposed to do. He's coming out of that tradition in many ways, and so he's already kind of deeply rooted in thinking about text in a religious context, and religious discourse is something more than mere communication. And very much engaged in the whole German project of differentiating the natural sciences from the philosophical, from the human, from the arts, from the different forms of discourse and truth that the different disciplines engage in, and indeed art history. So we've got that on one hand. On the other hand, Gadamer brings to his work basically the fact that he was in classics. He fought very hard for that. His father wanted him to be a biologist and thought that this classics rubbish was quite risible and very silly. And Gadamer fought hard for it against the disapproval of his father. He had to enlist his teachers to try and convince his father that he'd be okay. And he wrote. And he said at various points he was up. It was sad for him that his father never really got it, and his father didn't really live long enough to see people go, "Hey, your son's amazing. He's changed the way that we think." So he never really got that. Poor Gadamer. He's very, very much the small, humble, gentle guy. He never got that affirmation. And remembering he didn't write, he didn't publish Truth and Method until he was 60. He spends the majority of his life as a small guy. Listening, thinking, working diligently, slowly, and hard. And so he brings this classics background to what he does. Now, many people, of course, have classics. Nietzsche is a classicist. Heidegger, in many ways, is a classicist. He starts off with reading Plato and Aristotle, etc., although more from a theological perspective. Gadamer is not coming at the classics from a theological perspective or even from the perspective of the history of philosophy. He's really interested in them. And I think that's also essential. In a sense, Gadamer is there at the beginning of cultural studies. He's there at the beginning of Orientalism, remembering that classics, again, at that time included Persianists. You encountered Sanskritists. He was aware of the study of Sanskrit, probably did a little bit himself, not enough to get into it deeply. But for him, classics is the place in which you study other cultures rigorously, carefully, with regard to their texts, but automatically with regard to the historical context that informs those texts. So in that respect, he's positioned in a way that none of these other theorists of language, meaning, truth, etc., are, to try and say this is what's actually involved in thinking seriously about these materials. And he does, in fact, have a huge impact. He, in some ways, he also is articulating insights that other people are echoing at the same time. So Foucault comes along and wants to speak about how history shapes our understandings. This is very close to what Gadamer is saying about the way that history shapes our understandings, and those are the texts that we read. Quentin Skinner in analytic philosophy comes up with speech act theory and is interested in embedding what is said in the moment and in a whole way of living and acting at the time. Paul Ricoeur's narrative ethics, the idea that to speak is to describe a whole narrative. Gadamer very much is keying into this, the notion, even Clifford Geertz, again in the sort of the 70s, a little bit later, but not that much later, talking about worldview and the way in which all of our truths are and motivations indeed are embedded in worldviews. All of this stuff is kind of happening at similar times. And Gadamer was just a little bit earlier, maybe, than many of them. 1960, Truth and Method comes out. 1975, it's translated into English. But he's providing the philosophical foundation that shows them how and why this is the right way to proceed. He's the one who allows them to defend, explain what they're doing. And that's hugely influential. In religious studies, they were having a lot of trouble. Phenomenology had been appropriated, was being appropriated by everyone from Gerardus van der Leeuw through to Ninian Smart. And Smart's trying to make use of Husserl, which he does with some success, but also with a fairly profound lack of philosophical understanding of what he's doing. And this is where Gadamer becomes really important. And so now, of course, if you, I just marked whatever it is, 30 essays on the insider-outsider debate from Cambridge. And it's clear now that once you go, okay, so Smart's great, but in fact you can't step into another man's moccasins, as Smart puts it. You can't use empathy to leap into another person's mind, and you cannot actually engage a full epoché, a bracketing out of your own prejudices. For a while, again, when I was actually here in Oxford, I think the feeling was that the insider-outsider debate meant that we just can't study other cultures. There are all these undergraduates throwing up their hands, going, oh no, all of these years put into my degree, and in fact, it's impossible for me to ever study and understand another culture. And of course, post-colonialism, you know, is one more focused and ethically kind of intense version of that debate. But now, of course, what happens is you just answer it with Gadamer. Where you say, yeah, okay, so I won't fully understand you. Done. Right. But in fact, I can understand you very well or very badly. And that's true regardless of the cultural issue. In a way, Gadamer is, because he's philosophically grounded, he dissolves the cultural issue. He says, yeah, I can hardly understand somebody from wherever, from Manchester or Preston or Slough or half of my family or whatever, right? That in fact, the problem of understanding others is not a cultural specific thing, that traditions are not cultural traditions alone, but are whole traditions of your own person, of your particular upbringing within a culture, etc., right? So that in fact, it may be easier for people from two different cultures to understand each other than people from within the same family, but with radically different experiences or outlooks. And he says, so he relativizes that notion of cultural differentiation. And he also effectively says, this is a universal issue. No one has ever understood each other fully. In no conversation have you ever understood the other person fully. But that hasn't been an issue up till now, because you understood them pretty well. And in fact, you then continued to confirm your engagement through interaction. You left open the possibility that they were going to need to help you understand better, and that's just how we understand human beings. And indeed, that's a helpful and quite a, again, it's one of those things that it starts off being scary and then it turns out quite positive. So you spend your life with your husband or wife. Do you at any stage understand them fully? Do you at the end understand them fully? Well, they don't fully understand themselves. They're constantly changing, right? And so your project of understanding them is constantly changing. It's a dialectical process, as he put it, from a Hegelian perspective. And that's exciting. That's good. It's interesting. It keeps you on your toes. It's a dynamic process, in a sense, a creative process. It's an ongoing understanding as a project, not a done deal. It means you have to remain in engagement with the other person so that they can keep checking you, so that you can keep checking yourself, you can keep correcting your understanding. So it actually requires a relationship. That's also potentially quite a positive thing. And indeed, the whole thing is when you use it as a mirror, reflects the fact that you yourself are in of a never fully understood sphere. And your project of understanding yourself is also an ongoing, unfolding, fruitful, flourishing, exciting, ever-changing project. So this, once you kind of get that in there, and this all becomes easier to say now that it's, even when I first started my master's degree, you'd say, yes, but you're a Westerner, and that person's a Hindu, you're an American, and she's an English person. Already it's much easier now for everyday undergraduates to say, well, actually, I'm not sure whether I'm Western or Hindu. I was born in India, but I'm not sure I really believe in it, but actually I kind of grew up in the West. But, you know, like, it's a lot of, you know, people are no longer convinced by that. So this kind of dissolution of boundaries is almost a done deal. And he helped to solve that. He helped to clarify debates about the nature of religious belief. People were arguing a great deal about religious belief as a propositional business. Do you believe this? How does that work? And you'd had for a little while people like all sorts of people, whether it's Don Cupid, whether it's Nicholas Lash, a lot of people in theology going, my belief is not merely a proposition to be tested, it's a way of life. It's a statement of emotion, motivation, and value. It's a performance of the way I want to live, etc. Right? And Gadamer helps to bring that in. We'll talk much more about specifically his understanding of language in the next seminar, which is kind of focused on text and language, because he has this wonderful vision of what language and meaning do, which is incredibly exciting and wonderfully philosophically lucid, but which I think often isn't brought out fully. He helps to avoid religious conflict. The idea of clarifying discourse helps to avoid religious conflict. Helps to get rid of the idea that if you have a different view, you must be in conflict. We all have different views and we live together, and in fact, it's often the interaction that helps to clarify our views. More recently, I think he's relevant to the debate between text and body, the idea that we used to study text in religious studies, but texts are old. They represent the past, they reaffirm tradition, they represent only the literate part of the culture, usually men and educated, wealthy people. The texts restrict our understanding, and that they reflect a very narrow version of what, in fact, life was like at any particular time. So, text is seen as this kind of like constricting, conservative way of studying religion. And that's been kind of counter with a lot of people who've said we need to move on to other forms of religious expression, study embodiment, let's study other things. And that which is a really useful and important point, it can turn into a fight. So a few people have tried to turn it into a fight. And what, in fact, again, Gadamer kind of helps to do is to say, these are all texts, right? Whether it's a written text, whether it's a acted text, ritual text. Whether it's the text of a habitus, just what you do every day is a text. Whether it's a particular action at a particular moment, that too is a text. The famous text by Geertz on Gilbert Ryle's wink example, you know, if I wink, that's a text. It's not an action, it's a text. And you have to know the language to read the text. Am I winking because I fancy you? Am I winking because there's a secret something hidden behind the curtain? Am I winking because, etc. Right, so everything becomes text, and that helps to, and in fact, that's quite right, because if you study an art, a poetry, a ritual, you need to understand the discourse in which it speaks, right? So in a way, we go from text versus body to a broader sense of discourse theory, understanding different forms of discourse. So all that's great. Even the nature of religion, Jonathan Smith says, sorry, people like Russell McCutcheon say, don't use the word religion. Other people say, don't use the word Hinduism. These words are inappropriate. They're over-concretizing. And you get others coming back. And actually, Jonathan Smith does say this. He says, the word religion emerged about 200 years ago for the specific purpose of helping us to study a range of different really important cultural forms and certain distinctive elements about them. And so, as long as we continue to use it in a proper appreciation of its context and its correct discourse, it will be hugely useful to us. Right? Don't conflate discourses. That will always cause problems. And Gadamer explains why that will cause problems. It's the source of much problem and philosophical confusion throughout history. But again, we can just clarify that. We can sweep away a lot of debate and unnecessary publication. And maybe the last thing that he does is he helps to show that globalism itself, And this hasn't been brought out fully, but the ways in which globalism can be a positive. I think that's a debate we're still in. And the word globalism, we're not yet sure whether, if you look at funding bodies and conferences, people aren't sure whether that word means something bad or good yet. It's kind of on that borderline. Globalism as cultural takeover, as the creation of a monolithic culture, globalism as economic takeover, as capitalist or media globalism, often bad, right? Maybe some people are arguing that it's good, I'm not sure, but that's one meaning that's given. And I think more and more people are also trying to say, yeah, but in some ways globalism's what we've been aiming for. We've been aiming for the ability to have a world in which we are aware of the broader context, incorporating other cultures and perspectives, and A, can live effectively in that broader context, because in the end it's inevitable you're going to run into the other tribes in the forest. Right, so it's a universal human problem we need a solution for. We need to be able to deal with it, and indeed, ultimately, ideally, we can use it to form another or a different or a secondary identity which is pleased to be part of the global context. Right, so can we be happy to be whatever students in England and also be happy to be organisms on the earth? Right, and whatever, you know, one day we'll be happy to be sentient beings in this galaxy. But whatever larger identity group, can't we have to be able to appropriate that and be identities within it without that causing us problems? And Gadamer, again, I think, kind of wants to say, yes, that's doable, that's fine, that's good. And indeed, his the fusion of horizons, this phrase for which he's famous, which I'll come back to in the next class, is partly about what happens when you take a horizon. And you bring in new data, which expands it, right? And the idea that new data challenges your horizon and your horizon collapses or is somehow problematically harmed by that. Gadamer contrasts with the idea that what happens when you take two horizons, put them together, is they fuse and make a bigger horizon. Interestingly, Habermas, the kind of left, quote unquote, leftist German thinker who Gadamer actually helped get the job at the university he was in, criticized Gadamer. He said, "You're always talking about tradition and prejudice and saying we need tradition and prejudice, they're universal and they're good. You conservative, you, right? You're not helping people to change, to grow, to rebel, right?" And Gadamer said, "You're missing my point. I'm making a philosophical, not a sociological point. This is an insight about the way things are, not a polemical, rhetorical suggestion for how we should be. Don't be traditional. You are traditional, but tradition can generate revolution just as easily, or in theory, just as easily as it can generate a more conservative way of life." Right. So no one's more tradition determined than Che Guevara. The whole point of a revolutionary is that he's fighting against something in the past. Right. So, but that's okay. Right, that doesn't limit you, rather it enables you to act. So if you look at the chapter on prejudice and truth and method, it's on prejudice as an enabling condition. And that really represents the idea that he wants to bring out, is that every encounter is an opportunity to grow. And actually, of course, the message underneath that is, and you better grow because you can't avoid it. Right? You are already doing it. So embrace it and do it well. So in that respect, he has all these ways in which he impacts on these debates, which are constantly flowing through religious studies. And I think maybe the last thing I want to sort of bring out, the main point that I want to take out of that is where does he get this from? Where is it coming from? What is the history that's enabling that? Rather than go through sort of a detailed biography of Gadamer's life, possibly you know the basics. He's born kind of a middle-class family. I told you he's got this kind of pietist and also secular biologist background. He's clever enough. He's not from a particularly wealthy family. He's clever enough. He goes into university. He's really good at text. He loves classics. He goes into that against his father's wishes by and large. Does well. Is a good one of these detailed, rigorous scholars. Ends up with key teachers. He, in his personal biography, he wrote an autobiography, which wasn't an autobiography in which he didn't talk about himself, but had chapters on all of his teachers and people who influenced him instead. It's very dialectical. I don't think he was meaning to be particularly sort of self-reflectively cool, but it kind of works. And he writes about Paul Natorp, Max Scheler, this phenomenologist who gets forgotten, but who's really interested in value and passion, emotions. He's the phenomenologist who was interested in emotions when Husserl was only interested in logic. Influenced, of course, by Heidegger, by Bultmann, by Gerhard Krüger, Richard Kroner, Hans Lips, Karl Jaspers, Karl Lowith, and others. And his experience of being a student with Heidegger is very important. Heidegger's incredibly powerful figure. He has strong sense of how you should study and how you should live. He leads his students on walks through the forest, discussions, debates. He has new ways of studying text that are very powerful and personal. And I think all of his students feel called to be a certain person under him, and that's incredibly powerful as an experience. And at the same time, it makes someone like Gadamer kind of think, oh my gosh, right, at some point I'm going to move away from this. And when he does eventually move away from it, Heidegger himself was a bit disappointed with Gadamer, kind of thought, this guy's not going to be my top student. He's not a big enough personality. He loves to sit there with texts too much. He's got this weird affection for Plato, which obviously Plato's problematic. And he's, you know, interestingly, of course, Gadamer's not driven by a theological concern to save his soul or to rediscover God or to take history back to God or what have you. He's not driven in that way. Eventually, he gets his own position. He moves out from under Heidegger. He more or less manages to retain his kind of integrity during the Second World War when everyone's having trouble, everyone's having to take positions that Jewish scholars have been forced to leave open. Gadamer does so with a certain amount of grace, expresses his regret to his Jewish colleagues. He comes out of it in a reasonable state, as it were, and makes it clear later, I think, that he doesn't support the kind of rhetoric that fed into National Socialist thinking in a way that actually Heidegger didn't manage to really do. So he comes out of it, he's a figure. He finally, at the age of 60, is encouraged to go ahead and write your big book. Like, everyone else is writing a book with two nouns, time and being and hope and da-da-da-da-da. And they're like, he's going to do truth and method. And they're thinking, oh, that sounds exciting. But anyway, he writes it. He writes this long, detailed book that's basically a history of philosophy. And I'll talk more about that book, because actually, if you read it properly, if it needs a guide to it, it's this amazing story about how truth was focused on some kind of creedal notion of whether or not this is true or not. Was there a Jewish scholar called, you know, Jesus in such and such century? Whereas he starts off by saying truth should be based on art. The notion of art and what happens when you see truth in a painting. Let's use that as our model for what truth is and explore that through history and then come back to see what we've lost, right? And then he writes this amazing piece which shapes a different understanding of what humanity is. But that's not necessarily seen at the time. Slowly, Truth and Method becomes a major and influential text. Gradually, he starts to get invited to all these big conferences. It goes into other languages, and he starts to get acknowledged. And he gets attacked, of course. On the one hand, you get hermeneutic scholars saying, you're too liberal. You're letting truth be anything. It's all about context. It's where's the solid message of the text? And he says, well, as I'll explain next week in the next seminar, there is a truth there, and you don't get to... He's not a subjective relativist. He does not say, hey, it's whatever you think it is. It's whatever you want it to be. It can be anything. He says, no, you get it or you don't. But that's different. You have to understand that in a different way from the way it was understood in the past. So he kind of defends himself against that critique. And then he has to defend himself against the critique that he's too conservative, having been too liberal. And he defends himself against Habermas. And finally, kind of more or less wins out and becomes embedded at this level of... the idea of truth and understanding that almost everyone is using. So that when he finally dies at the age of 100 and... how is he? 102? He can feel pleased. He never really gives the impression that he felt desperately pleased. You know, but okay. He was okay with it. And I think he goes back to this notion, almost back to the Stefan George poetry circle. If he can be there with a group of people finding truths in sources, engaging deeply with material, being inspired, that's good enough for them. We read the Peter Sloterdijk book, and that's that early chapter where he talks about looking at the statue and hearing what the statue is telling you, I think very much goes back to what Gadamer says again and again about text, and which for him is preeminent in poetry and Rilke and Celan, who he loves. I just want to hear what the world is saying to me, hear what being is saying. And so I think that that's the biggest part of really what I want to say. His alternative history of the West, we'll hear more about in due course. But I think where people like, you get an impression from Heidegger that there's this forgetting of being. He writes a giant super narrative of history where at some level, especially in the pre-Socratics, change and flow and embeddedness in the world and this miracle of being in existence and receiving the messages of your constant perception, your phenomenological world, is wonderful and rich and full of meaning. And then we forget being by over-concretizing it, kind of almost a Feuerbachian idea. You take it, you take meaning and you turn it into something there. Truth is out there, you're going to get it, but you haven't got it right now. And this kind of almost alienation, it's back to this kind of notion, alienation of the self from the world, is the beginning of a terrible, terrible thing. And it also, of course, alienates us from God, who is now seen as some being up over there. Aristotle's notion of being as something out there helps to take us away from God as well. And Gadamer doesn't really feel that way about history. For him, there is a different story to be told. For him, Plato is still getting it right. So he, rather than reading the Republic and say the Phaedo, the key text that many people get given, he goes and reads the later Plato, takes like the Parmenides, in which Plato says, you know, while I said there were the forms out there, actually the forms are, again, we'll come back to this next week, but the forms are complex. They're multiform. There is no single form of the flower. Or if there is, it is not a unity, but a plurality containing all flowers and all variations of flower. It's a concept that refers to everything that is not flower. It is a context that concept that is embedded in our understanding of everything in the world. And your understanding of flower comes from every flower you've ever encountered and every non-flower you've ever encountered. Right? So meaning, Gadamer wants to say that even for Plato, who seems to concretize meaning and truth into these mysterious forms that we're trying to get to, so if you read the later Plato, he's acknowledging that, in fact, meaning is this pervasive, infinitely complex reality that is deeply embedded in your own experience in life and in all other concepts, right? So there's change, there's plurality, there's richness in every concept. And he says Plato's already got that. And he kind of charts, if you look at truth and method, if you look at philosophical hermeneutics, if you kind of do a study of just a list of the thinkers who he cites most, you get a lot of figures who get forgotten, as it were, by history. You get the Hegels, you get the Leibnizes, you get the Spinoza. It's interesting, and this will come up in the third seminar, you get a lot of the thinkers who were involved in the Pantheismusstreit, the pantheism controversy that happened in Germany, when people were suddenly, everyone was accused, Jacobi and Kant got involved, everyone was accused of being a Spinozist, a pantheist, right? And then you had to defend yourself. I'm not a Spinozist, I'm not a pantheist. And that kind of keys into people like Hegel and Leibniz, Schelling, etc. To some extent, it keys into people like Fichte, who are looking at consciousness as a fundamental element of existence. And those people get a bit left. It is still true, they get left out. We kind of jump from Descartes to Kant, and the Hegelians get in there, but Hegel's a little bit unfashionable in some ways, and we don't see a continuity from Descartes to Kant with Hegel in the middle, and Spinoza's kind of the oddball in history. So you also get a lot of thinkers, and later that comes out in Truth and Method when he talks about vitalism, thinkers in Germany who are interested in the idea of nature, history. Remember, for Hegel, history, nature, consciousness are all part of the same constantly flowing and upwelling reality. You're not making those cuts anymore. And Gadamer is kind of buying into a lot of those thinkers. There is a single medium. It's an infinitely rich medium. And meaning, the meanings, the concepts within it, the Platonic concepts, are not single, mysterious, Gnostic entities far away, but they're constantly upwelling meanings with infinite aspects to them. They're pluriform, if you like. And for him to take through that history that Heidegger kept trying to push him away from, and to say, you know, Martin, a lot of what you're trying to say about being, especially in, I think, the later work of Heidegger, actually is here already. We just need to tweak it. We need to see the little ways in which they went wrong or were misappropriated later. He talks a lot about how Kant got so much right, but certain motivations in what he wanted to prove, certainty, the desire for certainty, shifts people into kind of mistakes. Kant takes a lot of that wonderful heritage, gets a lot of it right, but also sends us down a slightly wrong path. He's not like Heidegger, and then everything's forgotten. He says, for each thinker, find exactly what's right and what's wrong. So you're always appropriating, never fully rejecting. And he says we can get back that material. And he's very interested in following through Kant's aesthetics and how that, in fact, continues some sense in which we're still in a meaning world. And we're still in a world in which the ethical virtues I'll talk about in the last seminar, the virtues of discovery, of exploring, of engaging yourself with the world or with the poetry or the art or with others, of letting yourself be changed. Right? He's really into the idea that you're letting yourself be changed and that you can't not anyway. So you're only fooling yourself if you think you're not being changed. That all of that is something that aesthetics can teach us about, and that is, in fact, I think for him, part of spirituality. He talks about Augustine. And Augustine writing about the notion of an inner word. Within scripture, there's the word, but there's an inner word, and the inner word enters into you and changes you, right? And that indeterminate space, which is always changing, altered, never concretized, never fixed, is actually really important for his understanding of spirituality. And it comes out again when he talks about poetry in Paul Celan later, that what the poetry does is it goes to you, it gives you structures, but in the end, it's always calling forth your inner word, which is unfixed, but kind of, he talks about breath. Breath comes out of us in no particular shape or form, and as it exits, we give it shape with our vocal cords into a linguistic structure. Back down inside, where it all comes from and is all always waiting to happen, it's soft and uncertain and unformed and always potential and fruitful, right? And for him, that's a spirituality that maybe, again, with his kind of pietist background, something he can really relate to, and that doesn't seem problematic when you think about different cultures, different perspectives. That's a spirituality that supports expression and engagement rather than supporting conflict. So that's the Gadamer I'm going to be talking about in the next seminars. The end. See, I think he sounds like a nice guy, right?
Very nice guy.
Nice guy. After a while, I was like, oh, I'm not studying the glamorous philosopher. I'm studying the nice guy. It's okay. Any thoughts or questions?
Well, it seems like you have to be a nice guy in order to kind of implement what he's talking about, and that leads me to think that are there other is there a certain other requirements to be like able to kind of enter this
This way of
world way of
thinking.
thinking, and is this kind of secluded from like
Yeah.
are other people not able to
To
partake in
enter
that
in.
kind of thing?
That's a really good question, both sort of sides of it. And the answer is no. The reason that my wayward PhD had the word realism, actually originally it was realism, religion, and passion, and it turned into reality because nobody knew what I meant by realism. But realism, because he wants to say, this is not how it should be, this is how it is. This is a realist philosophy. You can't avoid the things I'm telling you. You can just do it in a range of different ways. And probably that kind of keys into it. So he's saying you're going to be doing this. In a way, maybe then he's saying you can do it angrily. You can do it happily. You can do it creatively. You can do it. And I think probably he would even go further. He'd take out a lot of the ethical sound in that. We're very in a very polemical period of history, I think. He'd say, look, you can do it whichever way you want. You can do it while clinging to things that you've earned from the past. You can do it while jumping forward into the unknown. You can do it in a Deleuzian way by constantly disrupting what you think as much as possible, right? You can do it in a very different way by trying to build slowly a very coherent single structure. You can change and create truths and fuse and engage in a range of different ways and tones. And so in a way he'd say you're always going to be living his philosophy. But that's right, you can do it in different ways. And it's probably true, you could still say you could be a globalist dialoguer.
Mm-hmm.
Dialoguer. Happily.
Mm.
Or you could be, you could be the less nice person. I mean, and again, I don't want to say it's not necessarily not nice. It might be there are periods in history where it's good not to dialogue or to defend, you know. Sure, I just came back from Peru. There are lots of tribes out there probably thinking, we should probably dialogue less. Because at the moment, everyone's taking over, you know, we've lost everything, right? So I think maybe...
I think that's happening across the world, actually. Yeah. A lot of people are thinking along those lines.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. I think, you know, the 80s, everybody was like, uh-oh, we just went global. Oh, my God, MTV, cable TV's everywhere. And we're also... And we changed so quickly. And now maybe a different message is needed. So I think... Maybe that is one of the reasons he doesn't come out sounding prophetic. Say you should live like this. He just wants to put it down there and says what you're doing.
Mm.
Take it where you want to go.
If that's the case, then it's, so like what distinguishes, let's say, a Gadamerian,
mm.
you know, someone who's kind of allowed themselves to be informed by his insights,
mm-hmm.
from someone who, you know, let's say in a particular
mm-hmm.
Study of a text or a period in history, what would
yeah.
distinguish the two kinds of ways of approaching
mm-hmm.
A study of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. You could say, what are the problems that arise if you decide to not be a Gadamerian? Because you'll be doing what he's saying anyway, but in a different... But the idea is you won't know it. So you won't have the self-awareness of going, oh, but this is what I'm doing.
Okay.
So you'll be doing it but not realizing what you're doing. Which means what? In some ways... you'll just be carrying on. It's not a big problem. You know, during the Inquisition, the church was being influenced by other cultures. It was not saying, hey, this is what's happening. Well, look, we're transforming. This is the nature of history. They weren't being Gadamerian in that positive sense, but it was happening to them. And you might say, okay, so what's the difference? And it's a good question. Yes, maybe it's just a question of self-awareness. It's a question of, I think it's creativity is important. It's a question of whether you're aware of what you're doing and can do what you want with that process, or whether it's happening to you and you're not in control of the things that it's doing, right? So I, you know, let's say somebody falls in love for the first time and after a while they're a bit scared because the person's changing them. And that could be a source of great concern and confusion and fear, actually, or resentment, or they want to stop it from happening. Stop that. I want to stay myself. Don't, you know, and maybe that's the point at which you have the Gadamerian and the non-Gadamerian. The non-Gadamerian said, you know, tries to fight it, perhaps, or makes mistakes based on their misunderstanding of the circumstance. That's what Gadamer would say, is we've had a lot of cases where people just used completely inappropriate concepts of truth. And it just didn't make sense, and they had conversations that didn't make sense, or they got angry or something. And the difference would be the Gadamerian goes, oh, I see what's happening. Okay. And I accept it, or I'm going to alter it, or whatever, but I understand.
So there is a kind of prescriptive element in it, in the sense that it would, if we all became a bit more reflexively aware, the world would become, and scholarship would become better, in a sense.
I think he probably would say that it would become better in both senses.
Yeah.
So it would be better in the sense that we would understand the text better, we would understand communication better, we wouldn't try and communicate in ways that just don't make sense. We would try and do it in the way that makes sense. And so we'd be better in the sense of more accurate. And he probably also would say that, yeah, we'd be better. Like at some point in one of these, he didn't do much with world religions, but at some point he said, why have we only, there was a meeting with him and Derrida and some other people, and he said, why have we only got people from Christian religion, or so Western religions here? Where are the Muslims and the Hindus and stuff? Like, we have to do this. And that's him kind of saying, you know, we could do this better in the other sense as well. But I think he also wouldn't be prescriptive in the sense that if you came to him and said, look, I want to do it the other way. I want, you know, like Derrida. I think if Derrida came to him and said, I understand now that I'm communicating, what I want to do is rhetorically highlight the dangerous possibility that I'll never understand anything. And Gadamer would go, okay, well, that's a really interesting thing to do. Cool, go for it. Right? If Derrida says, no, I'm doing that because that's the truth, Gadamer would have to say, I think you'll find it's not the truth. Right? But that, I don't know if that's prescriptive. That's more just saying, here's a clarification, take it or not,
yeah.
You see what I mean? So I think he still wants to avoid, I think I'm trying to make him, I'm trying to prescribe him, and I'm not sure that he would do that himself.
Yeah.
I'm only trying to prescribe him because everybody's getting so polemic. Live like this, live like that. Yeah.
And I had one other question about tradition, just in terms of, from the little that I've read of Gadamer, it always seems like a very kind of broad, fuzzy notion. And
mm-hmm.
you spoke today of sort of
yeah.
multiple traditions, and
yeah.
I'm wondering kind of if you could clarify the concept. What
mm-hmm.
does he mean?
Yeah.
And how would you distinguish between one tradition and another tradition?
I think it's a good question, and I think at the most basic level, it's hard with Gadamer because he's always explaining things by using examples from particular thinkers or particular disciplines or contexts. So he'll say something and he'll be like, is that what he means specifically? And in fact, often what he means is the bigger concept, but it's very confusing. Like, he uses the word language, and he doesn't mean, it takes ages before everyone goes, oh, he doesn't mean actual language. He means a more Platonic concept, conceptuality, which is the medium of meaning. So with tradition, what he often means is not a specific tradition, but he means past. He means history.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the word prejudice. We use that word completely differently.
Mm-hmm.
And what he actually means is the past that shapes you.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you realize that tradition can be all kinds of past that shapes you. You have an individual personal tradition.
Mm-hmm.
You have a tradition as a student in your training, a tradition in a particular culture, maybe more than one tradition. And indeed, actually, of course, the boundaries between these traditions are fluid. Like, what's your personal tradition, and what's your cultural tradition? What's your religious tradition? What's your, so actually it doesn't even make sense to say there's the one.
Yeah.
It's Habermas's mistake for saying, oh, you mean that we should all follow German conservative values? Gadamer's like, well, whatever. I mean, that might be part of your tradition, but not necessarily.
And then when one's sort of, studying texts from, let's say, Greek, kind
mm-hmm.
of ancient Greece, and there's a kind of continuity there, maybe,
yeah.
let's say, if you're studying them in the West.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, that that past has shaped you and you're now trying to understand it, and there's that whole... But how about a totally other sort of past that hasn't
mm-hmm.
necessarily kind of had direct impact on your formation? How would his thought work there?
I think for Gadamer, it was a really important experience where he went to study Greek material, and everybody's like, we can understand Greece because they are our ancestors.
Mm.
And at some level, a lot of those people got to it and they were like, I don't get this Greek material. They're really different. They speak a different language. They're from a different place in the world. They're from a different cultural matrix. They're much closer to the Mediterranean and the ancient Near East. They're not even really ethnically the same as the Germans. Like, why were these our ancestors? Oh, because Aquinas read it but changed it, right? So again, that's that notion of tradition often needs to be as much disrupted as it is kind of affirmed. If Plato isn't your tradition, what is your tradition, frankly? And the idea that some things come easy to you and some things come hard to you, I think he would say is relative. And if you spend the rest of your life now living in India, you won't be Indian, but you'll be partly Indian, right? And indeed, you might end up being more Indian than you ever were English. Or you may end up being more Indian than certain Indians who grew up in India but had a very different experience. So I think that whole notion of which is yours and which is not yours gets disrupted, and it's relative to what particular horizon you're living in. And that's important. And again, I think we can relate to that more and more as people who often aren't in a single tradition anymore.
Mm.
That makes sense? Yeah.
It does engender a kind of reflexivity on sort of just fundamental epistemic condition.
Yeah.
And like categories that are very charged.
Yeah.
Rationality, sort of intellectual history.
Yeah.
Intellectual history is somehow different than theological history. Why?
Yeah.
And so these kinds of presuppositions that go into these notions that kind of govern the way things are discussed. And
they get kind of dissolved a bit. But I think it's interesting that a lot of people kind of would hear these things and think, well, then what's the point? Like, what's the point of trying to even say what my tradition is? Like, what's your tradition? It's a bit English, it's a bit Indian, it's a bit this, it's a bit that, it's a bit that. It's so complex. We can't deal with it in a simple way anymore. And a lot of people went, well, then, you know, that's why hermeneutics is too liberal, too diffuse. And yet, you look at Gadamer, who writes these really detailed, boring books. He writes detailed, boring books because he's partly saying it takes work. You know what I mean? There's a moment in which I think a lot of people said, you've just destroyed our categories. And Gadamer would say, no, I haven't. You just have to do more work for your categories. So you really will have to chart Lucian's history, which cultures he was in, and which different elements. It's not going to be simple anymore. But if we do the work, then we get there. So I think he kind of would say, yes, it is hugely challenging, but we can still do it. Yeah, truth is still there for us. And that's next week's class, but that notion that if truth is a game, what happens with truth is that somebody throws you a ball, and you can either catch it or drop it. It's up to you. But if you want to catch the general gist of that truth, and of course it's going to become yours, but you're still catching something which is continuous, you have to do the work of catching it, right? You can't just pick up a different ball. You know, so there are conditions. The metaphor as it is unpacked means there are conditions for what it means to get it right still. And that's what I think people took a while to see. They thought he was another Derrida in a way.
And it's also something that's always going to exceed us, in a sense. We're never going to be able to fully grasp it, right?
Yeah.
So,
that's right. Yeah, exactly. And that, again, was very scary.
Yeah.
You never get it all. You're never finished.
Mm.
But at the same, you know, and that it is scary until you realize everything you've ever done has been like that.
Mm.
You know, there is no, the most certain thing you ever had was a ball that you were holding in that moment.
Mm.
But it wasn't a thing that was finished, done, and set. And it was always in movement. Everything is always, and that's okay. That's every, you know, if you send your mind to the most meaningful and determinate and certain thing you've ever experienced, that was subject to exactly the same rules. And that's not to downgrade it, it's to clarify what meaning is in the first place. And then it starts to get better. But the last thing I'll say, with Gadamer, he tried, they said, why didn't you just call it hermeneutics? Why is it, it's just about meaning and blah blah blah, and he said, no, it has to be philosophical hermeneutics.
Mm.
And they said, why? And he said, because it's philosophically rooted in the fundamental constituent features of what it is to exist.
Mm.
Right? These are things that are absolutely basic. And it's what they're universal, we're always already in it. No truth or beauty or meaningful anything could exist without there being all of these different structures, including the uncertainty part. You know, but that's enabling, that word keeps coming up, and not disabling.
Well, so really he means ontological hermeneutics.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what he means.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And he gets that from, you know, in that sense, he says, like, he still would say, I'm only unpacking Heidegger's ontology. But Heidegger just didn't do it well enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Is there then perhaps a certain naivety in Heidegger, thinking that you can get back to the sort of,
mm,
you know, beginning point or
yeah, I think so. I think he kind of thought so. I certainly think so.
Mm.
and that's, yeah, it was just a little bit. So, but of course, Gadamer, you know, a lot of what Gadamer is facing is very, again, a very rhetorical, polemical time. And, you know, Nietzsche writes, we've forgotten history. It's so exciting and powerful to write stories of history, and it's useful. And people needed it because they felt that history was totally messed up. But Gadamer's the guy who wants to keep coming back and saying, I think partly, and this is a very national socialist, post-national socialist thing to do, he's saying, if you keep silencing history or rejecting people, people, voices, movements, you're always going to have, in a sense, something that is oppositional, antagonistic, polarized. And that's not really good. So you're always going to need the little guy sitting there writing the slow, gentle, careful history of what everyone, part of what they got right, you know. Anyway, you can tell he's nice because he didn't have that scary mustache that Heidegger had. It's all about the facial hair.
Yeah.
You know? So anyway, next week, anyone who comes next week will talk lots about meaning and this amazing ontology of play, what it means to play with meaning, different kinds of games, meaning as a, yeah, this game that we play, and how to play meaning well. Okay.
Thank you guys.
Thank you for giving me an audience. Appreciate it.